Podcast 092, Canning, Worms, Chickens, and Weeds. Sponsored by my buddies at PantryParadis.com. They sell food preservation tools. Produce, prepare, preserve your own harvest.
It's recording.
Okay.
Yeah. It's on. Really. See the blinking light?
Yeah.
That's proof.
I actually wore out two crackberries in my former job, so I am very familiar with the blinking light.
The blinking light. Okay. So we're at the Inland Northwest Permaculture Conference, and now you guys, on the first day of the conference, you guys brought me a pie.
Oh, yeah.
It was apple pie made by Amish people. Is that right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
And now apparently you've listened to nearly all of my podcasts.
I wouldn't say nearly. I came in about halfway through the Paul Wheaton mythology, but I have been on the bus ever since. So.
All right. So here we are, and you guys have a booth here, right? So now, first of all, tell me your names.
Wilson Fettis.
And Kaya.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and you guys have a booth here. You're selling homesteader stuff. Is that what it is?
Yeah. Well, we like to provide the tools for the food production, preparation, and the preservation of your surplus.
Okay, and I know you guys handed me some of those lids. You got those reusable canning lids, which it's like I just kind of look at them and I kind of think to myself, well, maybe. I mean, I like the idea of reusing them, but they're plastic, and it says BPA-free, but then I have to think to myself, well, that's the icky thing that we know about.
Yeah.
So it makes me a little nervous. On the other hand, it's like, well, what's the alternative?
Right.
And,
exactly.
And do we really know about all the metals in those metal lids?
Exactly. Well, and you know, a lot of people don't know. The only other options on the market, of course, are the ball and the care lids, metal disposable lids, but those were both bought out by the same company, Jarden. And so either box, they're basically the same. And people tell us all the time, they have a stockpile of lids from 5 years ago, and when they hold an older lid in their hand and one of the ones they just purchased, the disposables that they've just purchased from the store, the quality is going down every year. And the newer metal lids don't have a very good rubber seal on them anymore like they used to. These Tattlers have a real rubber ring, and that makes all the difference in the world. They're also two times thicker, maybe three, than those disposables, so they stay on the jar. So if when you pressure can something, especially maybe something greasy like a meat, with a disposable lid, a lot of times that wiggles and moves too much to get a good seal. But those Tattlers do such a good job staying in place, so you have fewer failures, and they're really wonderful. And you get, even out of that rubber ring, that's reusable as well. So it's not just the plastic lid, it's the rubber ring as well.
Well, yeah, that rubber bit does look a hell of a lot thicker than anything I've ever seen. And I agree, the newer lids do seem like they're getting crappy. Now they've got like a white coating on the inside of some of them.
Mm-hmm.
And what's up? And on the disposable metal ones, what's that white coating? Do you have any idea?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what is in it. But I do know that if you were to have the, if you were to start something in your garden from an heirloom seed, and you have a pure vegetable there, and you go to can it. It is better than organic to you. And you put that disposable lid on it. You've now introduced a whole other chemical load into your food chain that you would not have had. And so that is a consideration too.
Yeah, I understand the plastic concern because I have that myself, and I'm very much against it when I can choose something else like a glass option, which we haven't had since they banned those. those, I think, a good 50 years ago. But as far as canning preservation, but those the plastic that they do use on those Tatler lids is a food grade plastic. And I had the opportunity to speak. The gentleman who created these lids, was it was actually back in the 70s when they came out. His son runs the company now, and I spoke to him directly one day, and he said that it's the exact same food grade plastic that is used in food processing for most of what you would buy in your grocery store, things you never would have known to be processed. Like if you were to purchase meat in a grocery store, beef, chicken, anything like that, all of the buckets and things that was held in a processing plant to get it to the butcher or even in the butcher's shop, that's the same kind of plastic. So a lot of our food, we don't, if we purchase food at all, a lot of our food has touched that same plastic, but it heats to such a ridiculously high heat. He said that if you ever reached that heat in your home or in your pressure canning process, the fire department would be there. So you don't have to worry about leaching.
So, and I guess it is, you know, away from your food, which is inside of that glass jar, and it's kind of like, you know, it's like the lesser of evils, I guess, because it's, you know, I like the idea of not having the plastic there,
yeah,
especially if we're going to be heating it up to 212 degrees. But on the other hand, it's like, you know, well, the metal one's got, I mean, what, we don't know anything with the metal one either.
Yeah.
And it's like, then there's the reusability factor. So it seems like it sucks, and yet there's nothing better.
It's moving in the right direction, and it's the only thing out there like it. And it is also made in America, which we really like.
Okay. What's your guys' website?
www.pantryparatus.com. P-A-R-A-T-U-S, paratus.com.
What does paratus mean?
It comes from the Latin word ready. So we started the company, it's a pretty long story, but just to sum up here, we started the company basically based off of Wilson and Kaya's theory of economics, and that is basically anybody who has a job is able to do so because we've gotten past the 1-to-1 ratio for calories expended versus calories taken in. So whereas if someone is doing subsistence farming and they are expending 1,200 calories and they can only produce 1,200 calories, then that is a 1-to-1 ratio. But as soon as we overcome that, and now you have someone who is producing the food, then you can have things like doctors, engineers, and other things to propel society forward. And so basically, we just want to get people back to the place where they are producing their food again, and ultimately reconnecting with the source of that, and that is that was our mission from the get-go.
And everybody has a surplus, they just may not know it. Sometimes it's in the form of a tree or a berry or even just a weed like a dandelion in your yard that you know no use for because you haven't had the opportunity or the experience to learn how to cook it or how to use it medicinally. But we believe that everybody has a surplus, and we really love to teach people how to discover that surplus, how to tap into it, and then how to preserve it for a rainy day. And it's also very difficult to give in charity if you yourself do not have that surplus. So if you can preserve your surplus, if let's say you butcher your chickens and pressure can it or something like that, now you have a jar to give to the neighbor who just found out he's unemployed.
I understand you guys have a lot of questions for me. I saw like a list.
Well,
is a short list? I mean, you got pages there, isn't it?
No, it's more like the upper margin.
Oh, that's it. I just get a piece of one page. All right, well, that's a relief. So, all right, what's the first question?
Well, it's basically just based off of bits and pieces of things that I would like to drill down on from the former podcast. And you had mentioned vermiculture, earthworms to feed protein for chickens, and that you didn't really think that was worth the effort. I just wanted to hear more on that, and because it sounds really period. But I mean, it sounds simple, but then again, digging a hole, that is also simple, but it is hard. So I just wanted to hear more on that.
Okay. All right. So first, I got to tell you that there's a little bit more to that whole story.
Okay.
So I had this idea that the optimal breeding temperature for earthworms, I think, is like 68 degrees or something like that. I can't remember what it was exactly. But I thought, oh, what I want to do then is I want to create a temperature that they're going to, you know, enjoy breeding. So I'm going to make a lot of insulation. And I went into my garage. I laid down like 20 bales of straw. And then I put a bunch of bales around the outer perimeter of that. And then I filled it up with like 18 inches of soil. And it had a big plastic liner in it to keep all the soil into the straw bales. But my idea was is that way it's going to help to hold the hold the temperature and hold the warmth in. And then I put a bunch of bales kind of on the top or over some parts of it. And then I had one spot that was open for me to kind of check on things and oxygen can get in and stuff like that. And then I put a seed heating mat and thermostat in it to keep the temperature at whatever this optimal temperature was. And I thought, I'm going to have 80 jillion scallion earthworms here. I'm so damn smart. And, and I came back out there every once in a while and checked on them. So for about 3 or 4 months, it's like, it doesn't seem like there's any more earthworms in here before. And I tried looking for the pods and stuff. And it's like, I just need to give it more time and everything. And then there was a point in time where it seemed like there were some little tiny guys in there so that they were breeding and there were new earthworms. And then the whole thing caught on fire.
Oh, no.
In your garage?
Yeah. Yeah, and straw bales, they can smolder a long time. And so it turned out I wasn't nearly as smart as I thought I was. And the big thing was is they really weren't producing the earthworms all that fast, because it's like it'd been 4 or 5 months. And I was like, okay, I saw some babies and stuff, and maybe they'll grow, and maybe they're... But it's like, boy, that was kind of a slow turnaround. And so, but, but it was all over the winter, too. But I think with all that straw bale, that might be enough with the heater in there and everything, that should be enough. And, turns out, I don't know. So I think what happened is you ended up with this one little tiny patch where it was a good temperature, and the rest of it was fucking cold. So I think that's what happened. But with the mealworms, then I had awesome production with the mealworms. And they would just reproduce like crazy. And then because they were eating pretty much just old chicken feed, then all I would do is just you get this big batch of them all ready to go with the chicken feed and throw it out to the chickens. So the chickens would just eat the chicken feed and the mealworms and just have a heyday. And a lot of it was is an experiment with the idea of Cornish rock cross chickens. They tend to be really lazy. They tend to want to just hang their head in the feeder and eat and not do anything else. A grasshopper comes through and it's like, it's like an inch away. I don't want to fool with it. And so I kind of had this idea that what I wanted to do is raise some Cornish rock cross chicks. Again, I've done Cornish rock cross chickens a lot. And I kind of thought, okay, what I'm going to do the next time, now that I got all these mealworms, is I'm going to go in there every day and get mealworms. And then at some point, I'm going to bump it up to grasshoppers and crickets or something like that. So that way, when they go out into the field, they'll know what one looks like and that it's got ice cream on the inside.
The yellow jacket jerky.
Or I can feed them some of that. Those yellow jackets, they were just coming like every other year or so. So it wasn't like a consistent game plan, really.
So you subscribe to the method then where they need to work for their food?
Well, I was thinking thinking that, like, because, like, pretty much all they wanted to do, like, you put them out on some fresh grass and you move them twice a day, you know, Salatin style, which is what I was doing at the time. I was kind of thinking that, like, pretty much they're just crapping on the grass and hanging their head in the feed bowl. And that's all they want to, do. And it's kind of like, the other thing is I'm selling the birds for about the same amount I'm paying for feed for them. And so I'm kind of thinking, I got to get the brain going and come up with something that's going to be better. I ended up with the paddock shift system, which was indeed better, which is, like, you know, way, 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 way better. But in the meantime, I was trying. And the other thing was, it bothered me. I mean, these chickens are bothersome. Have you ever raised Cornish rock cross chickens?
No. Other breeds, but not the Cornish.
They get to a certain age, like, you know, at 4 weeks or so, they look like they're already half plucked. They look like some kind of monsters coming out of some genetically modified organism laboratory. They're freaky looking things. And I, you know, the first time I ever raised them, they got to that half plucked stage. I'm thinking, I don't think I'm ever going to raise these again. And then it got to the point where it's like getting closer to harvest time and they started dying. So the first time I ever raised them, I lost 30% of them.
Oh, no.
But this is for first timers. That's pretty normal to lose 30%.
Oh, wow.
And it's kind of like, what am I doing wrong? And you know, they'll die at drop of a hat. Some of them got a broken leg. And this is a common thing with that breed. And so one of the solutions is to feed them less. And I think that might help to increase their appetite to try and eat bugs and everything. But I think part of it is that when, like, the first time I raised them, then, you know, my systems were not very advanced at the time. And what I was feeding them was, you know, just bought feed. And granted, it was all organic because I'm so passionate about that. But I really wanted to get them to be looking at other things. I wanted them to forage more. And if a grasshopper came in, I wanted them to think, that's the delicious stuff. And I think they just didn't have any clue. We argue a lot on the forums of Permies about what a chicken will or will not eat.
Right.
And I think a lot of the arguments that people have are rooted in the idea that the chick never had a mama hen to show it what to eat. And so then the chicks that are raised by a mama hen has figured out, like for example, the stuff with the yellow jackets.
Yep.
If a mama hen went to the little chick and said, this is delicious, then the little chick will know, and the little chick will follow suit. But if the mama hen never ate one, the mama hen never will. The mama hen doesn't know that it's food. So I think a lot of it is the mama hens are going to teach the chicks what to eat.
So it's a thumbs down then on the earthworms, but the mealworms, was that a thumbs up? Is that something you would do again with the mealworms?
Absolutely. The mealworms, because I kind of think that here we've got an animal that grows up in a jungle and has insects every day, all year long. And we're forcing this animal to not live in the jungle. And when we do that, we take on certain responsibilities for its welfare, to give it a good life. And I think part of giving it a good life is it wants to eat live bugs. They're like little Klingons that way. They want live protein, little fucking Klingons.
So what was your method to do the mealworms? Was it the catching the garage on fire method, or was it...
No, the mealworms, I brought them in the house and sat them down next to me. There you go, mealworms. I did. I had this big rack I built, and it held like 7 trays or something like that, and I stacked it up behind my chair where I sat to read my mail, you know, and anyway, I'm sitting in this chair, and then the mealworms are right behind me. They don't stink. They don't, you know, cry out.
Yeah.
Hey, how about some better food, man?
Well, we've had pretty good luck with our worm bin. We put on Marvin Gaye, and it just seems just to happen from there. So
yeah. Marvin Gaye, you say? Oh, right.
Yeah. I mean, that puts them in the mood, and they're just doing their thing in there.
And that's for earthworms?
We do earthworms.
Yeah.
But he conveniently left out our first attempt at earthworms, which was also in the winter. And so in the spring, we had a huddled, frozen fucking worm ball, basically.
Well, see, I was thinking that the key is that I wanted to raise them in the winter.
Yeah.
So winter was the important time to do the experiment because, I mean, come spring, they get all the bugs they want. Summer, all the bugs want. Fall, they're still doing good on bugs. But winter, no, that's when you gotta supply them.
Yeah.
And so then I was trying to come up with those kinds of solutions. And that turned out to be the one that I felt was the best so far. I'd like to hear from folks. But I thought that the whole yellow jacket jerky thing was going to be okay. But then they're not Klingon style, live.
Yeah.
And so that's not good. But we're getting closer. In a pinch, it'll do.
Right. Well, it is like baby food in the jar. The infant isn't actually going out there picking the pear, but it's still pears for them. It's baby steps for a chicken.
All right. We good on that question?
Good on that question. Next question would be Google culture and general covering of the ground. I see. I heard you say specifically that if you're using a wood chipper, you're not doing it right. And I wanted to kind of build on that to say that I see a lot of wood chips used as a covering on the ground. And I heard you mention about the pill bugs and the sow bugs and how that's just like, anytime in nature when you have a lot of one thing, you're going to have a lot of something else who really is thinking is good to eat or that they want to take up residence there. So the wood chipper and using that and, handling your own general wood yard waste kind of thing, what's your take on that?
Well, I got to say that I'm against the wood chipper. I mean, I've used a lot of wood chippers and stuff, and the thing is they're loud and smelly, and just using the damn thing seems contrary to the way I want to be doing my stuff. I just don't like it. And then on top of that, then it's like, let's say you take all your stuff and you run it through a wood chipper, and wherever you go to use this stuff, then everything is all kind of exactly the same. And then so you've lost a lot of your permaculture edge. Whereas if you put all this wood in the ground as branches and twigs and logs and whatever else, you got a lot of variety of sizes. Some of those things are going to rot faster than other sizes. Whereas if it's wood chips, it's all going to rot pretty fast. I mean, if you mix it in even with soil and whatnot, it's going to lock up nitrogen real fast, and it's going to take a long time to break down. And then will it glee? Will it not glee? Because it's organic matter, right?
Right.
So what's going to happen? It's like it just seems like too much. Now, we've got some folks that have done the thing with the wood chips, and they've had great success.
Yeah.
And but the other thing is like I kind of think like, okay, when I'm thinking about making a garden, I like to add texture to the land, because I think that's the way nature intended years ago. This land was all very textured, very lumpy, and I kind of feel like we're going to put that back with hugel culture. Is how we're going to do it. We're going to put it back with hugel culture, and so we're going to have the places where we walk in between the hugel culture beds and then the hugel culture itself. Now where I'm walking, I don't want to really improve the soil there. I don't want it to be so good that the grass is growing 8.5 feet tall. And it's like, no, it's okay if that soil's kind of subsoily. And so if I've got organic matter, I want to concentrate my organic matter to where I'm going to have my growies and stuff, right?
Right.
So that's going to be in the hugel culture beds. And the wood chips, I mean, it gets too consistent. I suppose it wouldn't hurt to have like a 2 or 3 foot section that's full of wood chips just to kind of see how it goes down or whatever, but I don't want to run the chipper. Have I answered your question, or am I just babbling?
No, that was very good. Yeah, that was it.
Okay, and your other question?
The other question was, with the fencing around the garden, if you go subterra under the grade 2 foot with a fence with the idea you're going to keep out rabbits and gophers and things like that, you were not keen on that, and I was wondering why and what is the best way to handle that?
Well, all right. I'm gonna say that first of all, if you start putting metal fence under the ground, what's going to happen to it?
It's going to rot away.
So why the fuck are you fooling around with it?
It's a temporary band-aid, I guess.
Because you're stupid or something, the best I can figure. You got more money and you got sense. stuff. I mean, like, what? It's like, you know it's going to fail, and yet you still want to do it anyway. Oh, I got lost money, lost time. What the fuck? I'll just do that.
And energy to dig that hole, too, right?
Yeah, it's a weight loss program.
So what is the best way to I guess, handle what it is you are trying to protect from I guess...
From the diggers.
From the diggers.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. So what you're saying is you got a problem. You got somebody coming in, sniffing around your garden,
coyotes
chewing
the chickens or mold
to
your...
Let's pick one and we'll solve that one. We'll move on next. You want to do coyotes now? You want to do something else?
Rabbits.
Rabbits. Okay, I could be wrong, but ain't they good eating?
Very good.
So I guess I'm having a hard time seeing the problem here.
Okay.
That's good.
We're good? Okay, do we want to move it on to coyotes now? Because they're not so good eating.
No.
All right. So I, you know, if you've got chickens and you're out in the country, how many acres you got?
Well, we are speculating on about 5 acres that we have.
Okay, all right. Livestock guardian dog. Okay, are we good? We're done?
We're done. Yes,
okay,
that's it.
That was
okay.
It.
Yeah. I have a question for you, too, though.
Oh. Okay.
And this comes to plant spacing. And so my question really comes to some things just don't thrive on top of everything else. And you already answered the wood chip question. So my question, I guess, is the plants that need a little more breathing room, a little more elbow room, what do you do to keep the weeds at bay? What do you do to help control them?
Which weed might be, name one weed that's like...
Knapweed.
Okay. All right. I'm with you.
Yeah. What is the permaculture answer to knapweed?
Give it the stink eye. Fucking knapweed. All right. Well, okay. First of all, let's think about, okay. Cause here's the thing is with permaculture, there's a lot of weeds that we think are like awesome plants.
Yeah.
Bring them on.
Sure. Dandelion.
Knapweed
yeah.
ain't one of them. Knapweed's a dirty little motherfucker. It's going to try and exude a mountain of niacin out of its roots and poison the other plants around it. So now, but the thing is you'll notice like in a lot of forest situations, there's little to no knapweed.
Right.
There's any situation where plants have plenty of water, no knapweed.
Oh.
Now, there are some times where there are exceptions to this rule. So, and a lot of times the exceptions are that knapweed's a perennial plant. So if you've improved the soil or, you know, still sometimes knapweed will give it a try. And basically, I would pull it. But I mean, a lot of it is that when you go in and you change the landscape and stuff like that with permaculture, then you have an opportunity to establish what you want.
Right.
And then once in a while, knapweed will come in, and I usually prefer to like, oh, I've got this extra 2 tons of moldy hay sitting around. I see some knapweed. You know, a lot of times I'll just smother it. Or you can chop and drop. You either chop and drop the knapweed and pile it. But it's kind of like bushy, kind of like tumbleweed. It doesn't smother really well. But you could pull it, and then you could chop something else, and then drop it where that plant was, thus smothering what's left of the plant. So I would say that knapweed is one that these days is pretty easy to beat. Another thing is that we've got a thread on Permies about knapweed, and we got a guy there who sells the different kinds of knapweed eating bugs. These are bugs that we brought because, of course, it's what? Russian knapweed. And so we got these bugs from Russia. This guy's got places to go get big gobs of them. And then he throws these, there's like 5 different kinds of bugs that, like, they only like knapweed. If they don't got knapweed, then they'll just die. So then the thing to do is check with him. I mean, he charges like $100 or something for a bucket of these, well, not a bucket, like maybe a little can or something of these bugs, and it takes them a couple years to get established, but they do their job. I mean, it's like they would rather eat knapweed. You know, if they can't have knapweed, they'll die. So nothing else, only knapweed. So then it's a good thing to have around. But on 5 acres, I think I'd stick to pulling. I mean, and the other thing is that if I were out shopping for property and it's like there's a property totally infested with knapweed, that would be the property I'd want to buy.
It would be
the property I'd want to buy, because that means that there are no persistent herbicides being used on that land. I have a bigger fear of persistent herbicides than I do of knapweed. Knapweed I can deal with.
Yeah.
The persistent herbicides, will haunt you for years.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, you know, you go and you plant something, and it's like always sickly and sad, and it's like, well, why is it? And then you find out, oh, yeah, 4 years ago, that guy was in there, and he hosed the whole place down with, you know, Copiralid.
Right.
So it was totally illegal, but he got a deal from Cletus, who has a license, and said he'd sell them for $40.
Yeah. I liked what Toby said about the people who organize themselves into councils trying to beat back weeds are usually pretty well backed by people who are trying to sell a product and that they recognize a repeat customer when they see one. So
yeah, you guys love those native plants so much. We'll see you back here every year trying to get a fresh start again. Yeah, this is awesome. All right, have we did we cover the napweed? But you know, you had a bunch of weeds, but now was it just napweed that was bothering you, or did you have a few others?
It had to do with just trying to learn spacing. That's really, I think, where my biggest problem lies.
Well, I like how Seth Polster goes about it. He gets a big bucket full of seeds and grabs a handful and fling, and then he kicks some dirt on it and he walks on. And it's like, good luck, plants. You're on your own. Work out your spacing. Why don't you?
Man, because I thought I was going to start seeing some spirituals out in the garden and under the hot sun this past summer, because I was just doing so much backbreaking work. I'm not doing that anymore. I think I'm going to take his method.
Yeah. You know, a big part of it, you introduce with permaculture, you're going to have lots and lots of edge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you got all your lumpy ground and everything, and then you got your tomato plant here and your tomato plant there, and that tomato plant looks all sickly and dying, and that's because nature's saying, you know what, that tomato plant doesn't belong there. I'm gonna take that tomato plant out. In the meantime, this other tomato plant is like huge and vibrant, loving it. Okay, that's where that tomato plant belongs. That's where it ought to be.
Well, maybe the other plant just had really weak kung fu, and that could also be the case.
Yeah. Let me write that down. God, you're married to this guy.
Yes, and it just keeps coming.
Okay. All right. So, did we cover the weeds question, the size, the space of the plants? And I mean, you know, if you're in an urban environment and you've got a 4x4 box and that's your whole garden, okay, I think it's good to sit down. Let's talk about how much space does a tomato plant really need, which is more than you think if you're doing it right.
Right.
So, but I mean, otherwise, trees, I kind of focus a little bit on trees and spacing, but not so much the annuals or the smaller plants. I let them kind of duke it out on their own. You know, wherever it's a spot that's good for a certain kind of plant, it'll do good there. And if I get dominated by just one plant, I think to myself, I don't have enough diversity in my edges.
Yeah.
I need more edgy bits, more variety of edge. All right. Is that all the questions? You got more?
I have two more. One, in Montana where we live, we have a problem with Eurasian milfoil. That is obviously specific to water. What's the permaculture answer for something like that? Like, how do you? I know that Toby's pretty keen on trying to absorb something that would ordinarily make other people bristle because nature is trying to do something there. But that, since that would be, to use the term, invasive, what's the permaculture path to try to make that whole again? You know,
all right. So so Mollison says you don't have you don't have an excess of slugs. What you have is a
deficiency in whatever the slugs.
You have a deficiency in ducks. That's a common thing that he says. Okay, so now you've got a bunch of milfoil stuff, right? You got a bunch of this green growy stuff in your pond or whatever, and and it is an exotic invasive-y kind of a thing. And so what's going to be the solution?
Moose.
Yeah, you need to get a bunch of moose in there. You need to have your moose. But that's actually true. Moose would eat that. And they're awesome. but at the same time, if you're kind of getting your dogs to chase off the deer because, you know, you want some food left for yourself, the dogs might try to chase off the moose. I'm not sure how well that will work out for your dog. But still, it seems like you're going to be trying to discourage moose and you're going to be trying to fence things off and whatnot. So moose probably isn't going to help you out. I had a similar problem when I was on Mount Spokane, and I remember I was exploring the idea of different kinds of native snails that might naturally occur in the water, and I thought I'd found some information on some, and I was kind of thinking, because I'm raising trout, and it's like trout are carnivores, and they will eat the snails, and so I was thinking, all right, so here's what I need to do, is I need to convert that milfoil into Purina Trout Chow, and so I was thinking that, you know, this was a way of doing that. And it's like it's gonna be there no matter what you do. Yeah. I mean, you could pull it all out and right, try and plant in a bunch of other stuff, but it's like it's gonna even that. I mean, how much stuff you got to plant to try and get so thick and loaded with plant life that the milfoil doesn't have a chance to get established? And I think it's gonna be there. So what you need to do is you need to come up with an ecosystem bump that's gonna be able to work with that. But I gotta tell you, I never got around to actually ordering the slugs or going out, the snails and going out and finding the snails. You know what? You should post this one out of Permies. Post this one out of Permies. What's that? You got that one? You got an answer for the milfoil problem?
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, they have a, there's some guys out of Cheney that do, it's like a culture. You're lacking it's a biological that you're lacking. And it actually kind of locks up the nitrate in the water. It's natural. It's supposed to be there. It's just not there now because of all whatever reason we've killed off the biological. So what they'll do is they'll reintroduce that, but there's also, it'll take care of it for a little while, but if you have excess nitrogen, the nitrates still coming in from other sources, say somebody's, you know, fertilizing extra nitrogen, all different areas, but you can reintroduce, I think it's tiny technology that they'll...
Right, so I hear people say tiny-o, but I always kind of called them tanyo. I felt like if you call them, it's tanyo. And their thing is they provide bacteria and whatnot that they think is going to be good for you. You were saying that they have, like, pond goo. They'll sell you... So they'll sell you a gob of pond goo, and the gob of pond goo is going to, you know, set the right kind of bacterials going on in your pond.
And they lock up the nitrates in the water.
Now, if you're talking about, because we're talking over here about algae. No, not algae. We're talking about plant life. I think you're talking about algae. Are you talking about algae? You're talking about the milfoil.
Yeah.
Okay.
They also have stuff that's supposed to, it's a frequency resonance tissue thing.
Right, right, right. They've got something like that.
It's like a
so, I know that one thing that,
it's one of those things where we mess up the environment enough where how do we, you know, we're trying to get back
okay.
there.
So, right, so I know that one, a common solution for algae is going to be that you're going to try and tie up the excess nitrogen that's in the water. So you're going to put bales of straw in there, but you got to make sure they're organic, because if those bales of straw are the ones laced with the chlorpyrrolid, aminopyrrolid, etc., it can kill all kinds of stuff in your pond. I've heard of people having really bad luck with that. You got to make sure it's organic, but then that ties up a whole bunch of the nitrogen that's in the pond, thus making it so that the algae won't grow. But the milfoil would also probably suffer a bit from that. And so then that's a possible thing. But I think that the thing to do, there might already be a threat out of Hermes about this. So, but if nothing else, start a thread out there, and then if you don't get any good answers, let me know. I'll try and think of somebody to contact who will be an expert in that space that might be able to give us some more feedback. So you got one more question for me?
I do. So when you moved from, so you knew that you wanted to have a farm, so you went into software engineering to provide the means to get to that end, and you still do both, and you still operate in both of those areas. I just wanted to hear more about that journey, because it just seems like it's, you know, a lot of people have a dream of doing something, and it's usually has a long process to get there, and you are on that. And I just wanted to hear, I just wanted to hear more about that from your perspective.
Well, have I ever put in one of my podcasts mentioned about the story of when I was 11 years old standing in the cattle chute covered in cow shit?
I missed that one.
Not yet. I haven't heard it.
Oh, I thought maybe I told the story already. But so I'm 11 years old, and my job is to convince the cows to move forward through the chute instead of backwards. And the thing is that cows don't really care for half an 11-year-old boy standing behind them. It makes them nervous. And when they're nervous, they can shoot shit 25 feet out their back end. So I was covered head to toe in shit. And so it was a hot spring day for the spring roundup, and I put on my insulated coveralls because I figured that way I have the best chance of not getting shit on me. You know, I knew I was going to get covered in it, but that would minimize it. But the thing is they're insulated, and it's hot. It's really hot. And it's like, to make matters really awful is that my uncle, who owns all these cattle, owns all this land, he's got this big old garbage can full to the top with ice and sweet cold Pepsi Cola. And we didn't get pop much in those days. And so the idea of having a sweet cold Pepsi Cola was like, and we were allowed to have all we wanted. But here's the thing, if I had a bottle in my hand, it's like, how do I get it to my mouth? Because it's like I've got my mouth closed tight because there's shit on my lips. All right? So I'm trying to think how, and it's not like I could wipe my lips on my sleeve. My sleeve's covered in shit, too. So how do you work this out? You can't. And it's like, you know, you don't whine about it, because this is a family where you don't whine. Don't you put your hands in your pockets. You look like you're lazy.
Right.
And so, okay, all right. Yes, sir. So I'm the guy standing in the chute. I don't know how I ended up with that job. I think everybody else knew how this worked out, and they wanted to have the sweet cold Pepsi Cola. So I got a moment there. The cow in front of me, I think she's less nervous now that she's emptied what she had, and she seems to be standing there calmly, and I get this thought in my head. Somewhere in the world, there's somebody sitting on their ass at a desk with a bottle of sweet cold Pepsi Cola, and it's air conditioned where they're sitting, and they're saying to themselves, should I take my break now? You know, somebody's got a job like that, and they're getting paid crazy big money. And it's like, what does it take to have that job instead of this job? So, and as weird as this sounds, the very next day I go to school, and the school has this brand new computer. I got real interested in that computer. And so so that was the beginning of my computer career. Turns out I had a bit of a knack for it. So I've done mountains of awesome and amazing projects. I've won awards that are like the Oscars for computer geekdom. So I did really good. At some point in time, I started raising a garden. In fact, the program I had at the time was called Bananacom. So anyway, I went bonkers over gardening, and I did my first garden, and it turned out I totally sucked at it. I was awful. Everything was pathetic. It either died, or the crop was miserable, and it was horrible. And so the next year, it's like, I'm not going to let that happen again. So I read over 100 gardening books all in one summer. Okay, so you were saying something like I took on the computers in order to pay for the land, but actually what happened was I was doing the gardening for a while, and then I got this idea of, I love this. I love it. I want to do more. And so I called it the cows and chickens plan. I want to get to the point where I got cows and chickens. I need the land. And it's like, at this one point I had debt, and so I left Missoula. I went to Denver, and they loved me there, and they showed their love with dollars. And so then I got out of debt. I got enough money to buy land, and then I bought land over on Mount Spokane. So does that fill out your needs to hear about my mix of my computer geekdom and my permaculture stuff?
It does, because you never lost your passion, you know. I mean, standing there in the cow chute and then standing there at the garden, you know, thinking maybe that the cow manure is better applied to the garden than to yourself, and you still did not have that beginner's luck, but you stuck with it. I just think that is very inspiring.
Wow. Good. Cool. When you say it that way, I sound really cool. I feel better. I like that. I like that. Okay, you guys got any other questions for me? Nothing?
No, we're good, but thanks for taking the time to answer them.
Well, if you like this sort of thing, come on out to the forums at permies.com, where we talk about being covered in cow shit, homesteading, and permaculture
all the time.